Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Lynn welcomes Dr. Harry Deshpande. Dr. Deshpande is Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology and of Otolaryngology and Assistant Clinical Professor of Nursing at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Lynn Wilson.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about what is it that you exactly do with relation to cancer and cancer patients.
Well, I take care of patients with head and neck cancer. I started here at Yale in 2004, and since then, I've been working with patients with what's known as head and neck squamous cell cancers, as well as other head and neck cancers, including thyroid cancers.
And how did you become involved in this field, Harry?
When I started at Yale, I took over the head and neck service. And since that time, I've been working very closely with my colleagues in the Department of Otolaryngology, or ENT surgery, as well as the Department of Radiation Oncology.
Tell us a little bit about your background and training, where you're from, what's your training background, what sort of amount of time did that take, and how do you develop the type of expertise that you have?
Well, to be an oncologist, you have to train, first of all, in a medicine residency, which is 3 years of treating patients with all kind of medical problems. You then specialize in medical oncology, which is another 3 years. And then at that time, you have a choice of either going into what's known as a general practice, where you can treat patients with any kind of cancer, or you can specialize in one field. And that's what I chose to do when I came to Yale. And really, it's something you're learning every day. Every day you see new patients with conditions that are maybe slightly different from ones that you've seen before. But we do have certain protocols that we stick to when we treat head and neck cancers.
So even though head and neck cancer is a subspecialty of oncology, there are quite a few different cancers in the head and neck area. And could you tell us a little bit about some of them?
That's correct. And in fact, it's almost a misnomer, because even though we say head and neck cancers, we're not talking about cancers of the brain, which obviously is in the head, but that falls under a different category. Head and neck cancers are cancers of what we call the upper aerodigestive tract. So that is really everything between the front of the mouth or the lips all the way down to the larynx, which is the Adam's apple that you can feel in your neck. So it's quite a small area, but within that area, there's many, many structures. The larynx itself is a very, very complex structure. The mouth, we split up into different areas, which we call the oral cavity, and then a little further back, the pharynx, which we subdivide into the oropharynx, the nasopharynx, and the hypopharynx. So it is quite a complicated field for just a small area of the body.
And tell us a little bit about what exactly that your part is in being part of the multidisciplinary team of doctors who manage and see patients with head and neck cancer. Tell me a little bit about the different specialties that are involved.
Well, that's really what I enjoy most about working with head and neck cancer patients, is we really do have a very good team of doctors. These involve the surgeons, the ENT physicians. The ones I work very closely with are Clarence Sasaki and Benjamin Judson. Radiation oncologists, including Young Sun and Roy Decker. And then Daniel Morgenstern, who's a medical oncologist, along with myself, see patients all together in, first of all, in a multidisciplinary tumor board meeting where we actually all see the patient at the same time. It's quite unprecedented for most tumor boards, but very useful for all of us as we get to ask questions to any patients that come in. Where I fall into the team is I'm in charge of the chemotherapy side of the treatment.
When you have this tumor board and the patient is actually there, you mentioned that that's unprecedented. Why is that unusual, and could you explain what some of the advantages of that might be?
Most tumor board meetings are meetings where all different physicians of different specialties get together and usually review a case of a new patient or a complicated patient. We would look at the x-rays or CAT scans and pathology, but usually the patients are not physically present in the room. In the case of the head and neck tumor board, the patients are physically there. And the advantage is you can put a face to the description of the case that's being described before you. However, sometimes not all patients like to be involved in this kind of tumor board. And so there are times where we wouldn't bring the patients to the tumor board. They may feel a little intimidated in a room full of doctors.
And I would imagine with head and neck cancer, Harry, there's a bit of an advantage for this type of evaluation, because in most of the cases, you can actually see the tumors when you examine the patient, as opposed to something in the gastrointestinal tract, which would be impossible to see without a special internal endoscopic type of technique or a CAT scan for lung cancer, that sort of thing. And so is that something that you focus on as a group? You can examine the patient together, actually see what you're talking about?
Right. That's absolutely correct. And whether it's a lump in the neck that you can see from across the room, or whether it's a lesion in the mouth that you can just see by looking into that patient's mouth, it's very easy to see and evaluate the primary or the secondary cancer that the patient has.
Now, I would presume that by all of you being there together with the patient, is there some sort of discussion with the patient, perhaps after the meeting, and does that enhance the efficiency of the clinical evaluation for the physicians and the patient, since there's perhaps getting access to all of the specialists in one visit as opposed to going from doctor's office to doctor's office over several weeks?
I think that's the main advantage of the tumor board meeting. The patients, I think, feel that everyone has discussed their case. Typically what happens is while the patients are in the room, we will ask a certain amount of questions to them. The patients and the families will then leave the room, we'll have more of a discussion, and then at the very end, supposing it's someone I've presented, then I will go back and discuss the findings with the patient. So it's a very involved process, but the patient is the center of all of the discussions.
I see. So someone could come in, say, that afternoon, be seen, come to the tumor board, and then before going home, may at least have a fairly detailed outline of what at least the treatment recommendations of this entire specialty team are.
That's correct. I mean, typically they do have to come back for a more detailed visit with, say, me if chemotherapy is involved. But yes, they will get an outline right there and then.
I see. So that sounds fantastic. Getting back to specific head and neck cancers, what are some of the more common ones in the head and neck area?
Well, the head and neck cancers that I see occur, as I mentioned, anywhere from the mouth all the way down to the larynx. The common cancers that we see include cancers of the tonsil, of the base of the tongue, that's the back of the tongue, and cancers of the larynx itself. They are not as common as lung cancer or breast cancer. Typically in this country, we see around 40,000 cases every year. And that's compared to, say, 200,000 cases of lung cancer.
Still quite a few cases, though.
Yes, that's correct.
What are some of the risk factors for head and neck cancer in general?
Well, this has changed, interestingly, over the years. So typically, cigarette smoking and alcohol in conjunction were considered the main factors for having cancer of the head and neck. However, since the 1970s, cancers of the oropharynx, that's the tonsil and the base of tongue, have increased despite patients not smoking as much. And so a lot of investigation has been done into that area. And what we now know is that these cancers and some of the other cancers in the head and neck are associated with a virus which is known as the human papillomavirus, a similar virus to what causes cervical cancer in women.
And how do those patients fare if they've got HPV or human papillomavirus compared to a patient who's got the same type of head and neck cancer, which may be unrelated to HPV and is brought itself to diagnosis because of smoking, say, for example? Do they behave differently biologically?
They do. In fact, there's been many studies reported over the past few years asking exactly that same question. And what we find is with exactly the same treatment, so that's typically radiation and chemotherapy, patients who have HPV-related cancers do remarkably well. And by that, the survival rates at 5 years are in the 80 to 90% range. Whereas if they have cigarette smoking-related cancers, they do not as well. So survival's in the 50 or 60% range.
Now, you had mentioned both smoking and alcohol consumption.
Yes.
Is each one a risk factor in and of itself, and the two of them together are synergistic? How does that work out?
Well, the two of them are definitely synergistic. So if you take oropharyngeal cancer, for someone who has a 20-pack-year smoking history who drinks more than about 5 drinks a week, then the risk of developing cancer in the oropharynx is about 40 times that of the normal population. And that's much higher than if they just smoke cigarettes alone. Alcohol drinking by itself doesn't appear to be a risk factor for head and neck cancer, but it does make the cigarette smoking more of a factor.
I see. And you mentioned in your example 20-pack years.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Oh, yes. That's a term we use in medicine all the time. Basically, what we do is try and quantify how many cigarettes someone's had over their lifetime. So we take the average number of packs they smoke a day and multiply it by the number of years they've been smoking. So if they smoke 2 packs a day for 10 years, it's a 20-pack year smoking history.
Now, the human papillomavirus, if you have a patient who has a tumor in the throat, how do you figure out if this is perhaps related to smoking or related to HPV?
That's a very good question. Right now, we test all the cancers of the tonsil and the base of tongue for the presence of the human papillomavirus. And recently, we've been able to do this using a protein called P16. If the pathologist finds P16 in that specimen, then that means that that cancer is associated with the human papillomavirus. We don't tend to test the other sites just because the incidence or the amount of cancers that are related to human papillomavirus in other places in the head and neck are not as high as they are in the tonsil or base of tongue.
Do you have any sense, Harry, of why things have changed over the last 20 or 25 years? Why hasn't HPV been a problem for 100 years? Or
yeah.
Why has it started to be a problem more recently at all?
I don't think anyone knows the absolute answer to that. We think it might be due to changes in sexual practices over the last three or four decades. But there's a lot of other reasons for this, which I think remain to be elucidated over the next few years.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about head and neck cancers with Dr. Harry Deshpande.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there's new hope. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI 101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Harry Deshpande, and we're discussing head and neck cancer. Harry, we had just been talking about risk factors for head and neck cancer, human papillomavirus being one of them. Let's get back to smoking for a moment. If someone is diagnosed with a head and neck cancer and they are a heavy smoker, is smoking cessation at that point something that is going to help them in terms of their treatment and prognosis?
Absolutely. What we know about many head and neck cancers, especially cancers of what we call the oral cavity, that's the front of the mouth, if you like, they often present very early on. Patients will see a lump, they'll go to their doctor and it'll be removed. So technically, those cancers are curable. If they continue to smoke, however, then the risk of the cancer coming back is about twice as high as if they stop smoking. So we really encourage those patients to stop smoking. And in fact, we do have an excellent smoking cessation clinic in the Smilow Hospital on the fourth floor where the patients can enroll and they're given help to stop smoking.
And is that for just patients who have been diagnosed and under treatment, or would that be for any patient who's interested in smoking with cancer, or who would qualify for that?
That's a good question. It's actually anyone who's smoking who is seen in the Smilow Clinic. Everyone gets a form to fill out to say, first of all, whether they are a smoker, and then if they are, then they have an option of joining that clinic, and we do encourage it.
Oh, that's terrific. The smoking for treatment itself, does smoking, for someone who just isn't able to stop smoking, and we've both known many patients because it's a very difficult thing, does this impact the ability to successfully get through the treatment program? Can it cause problems with the treatment itself in terms of side effects?
It definitely can. Head and neck cancer treatment is, I would say, one of the more difficult treatments to tolerate for patients. But the radiation, for instance, is being targeted to the neck. That's the place where all the air goes down when you're trying to breathe. It's where all the food goes down when you're trying to swallow. So it's a very difficult treatment for anyone to undergo. If you add cigarette smoking and all the irritation from cigarette smoke onto that, it can make it twice as hard to get through.
So thinking about epidemiology, besides some of the risk factors we've discussed, are there other types of behaviors or groups of people that might be at increased risk for head and neck cancer in terms of, is there more males versus females, younger folks versus older folks? Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
For the HPV-related cancers, which we'd mentioned earlier, it seems as though this is beginning to affect a younger population. But by younger, we're still seeing patients in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. In those groups, it seems to be affecting men and women about equally. For the cigarette smokers, however, it does seem to be more of an older man's disease. For instance, the ratio of men to women in some series that I've seen for larynx cancer, which is one of the more cigarette smoking associated cancers that we see in the head and neck, it's probably in the order of 4-1 to even up to 7-1 in some series, male to female ratio.
I see. What are some of the symptoms, Harry, that a patient might complain about that would be suggestive of a head and neck cancer, understanding that many of the same symptoms may represent completely benign and non-cancerous disorders, but when you see a patient who's got a diagnosis of cancer and you take their history, what are some of the more common symptoms?
That's a very good question, because it's one of the reasons I think people don't seek medical attention initially. All of us have had a sore throat or a cough or trouble swallowing or pain because of reflux, and we tend to ignore it for a while. But if those symptoms tend to continue for more than a couple of weeks despite antibiotics, then that's the time for patients to go and see their doctor. And specifically, these are a sore throat, difficulty swallowing, definitely if they have a lymph node in a neck, in the neck that doesn't go away, and also if they're coughing up any blood, that's an immediate red flag for more investigations to be done.
How about, aside from the sore throat, can patients have pain? Do these cancers hurt? Can they get ear pain? Are those factors?
They are. It depends where the cancer is. So if the cancer's in the tonsil or the nasopharynx, then that's very close to several of the structures that affect hearing as well, including something called the eustachian tube. So they can either have a feeling of a blocked ear or pain in their ear. We refer to that as referred pain. So the cancer is in one place, but they feel the pain somewhere else.
I see. And when you're evaluating such a patient, are there other tests sometimes that you want to get? What sort of things might a patient need to prepare themselves for?
Well, typically, they will go and see the ENT doctor after they've seen their primary doctor. So at that time, they will have what's known as a mirror exam, where the ENT physician will typically put a mirror at the back of the throat to be able to look down, further down into the throat than they could just by looking with their eyes. And then they may get what's known as a fiber optic laryngoscopy. That's where a flexible, small telescope is introduced through the nose into the mouth, and they get an excellent view of all the way down to the larynx to make sure that they don't see any abnormal structures.
Now, you had mentioned a little bit about treatment, chemotherapy, radiation, removal of a tumor. Is it generally fair to conclude that the smaller a tumor is, the more apt it is to maybe undergo a surgical procedure and just have a removal in one operation and be done and possibly cured?
That's absolutely true, although it does depend on where the cancer is. So in the front of the mouth, typically those cancers are very easy to reach with an operation, and they're treated, if they're very, very small, just with an operation alone. Further back, say in the tonsil or in the larynx, sometimes an operation to remove that would involve damaging structures that affect speech or swallowing. And so over the last 20 or 30 years, we've begun to do more radiation as a primary treatment for those cancers rather than an operation up front. But typically, they need only a single modality of treatment for very small cancers. In other words, either just surgery or just radiation.
For cancers that have spread a bit to the lymph nodes, for example, and you have to introduce a more aggressive treatment program of perhaps a combination of radiation and chemotherapy. I know you have a lot of experience with these combined regimens. What are some of the main toxicities that we see?
This is what I was referring to earlier, as I think one of the most difficult cancer treatments to undergo. The toxicities include pain on swallowing. Typically, when someone undergoes radiation for head and neck cancer, the side effects are quite bearable at the very beginning, but towards the end, the side effects become much worse. In other words, they feel more pain in the throat, it's more difficult for them to swallow, and they may lose a significant amount of weight. And for patients who do lose more than about 10% of their body weight, or if we feel they might lose that, then we typically will put a feeding tube. That's a tube that goes directly into their stomach to make sure they can get through the treatments. And we have excellent supportive care in our program, whether it's our nutritionists or the nursing staff or the other members of the team, who will monitor these patients very closely and make sure they get through their treatment with as few interruptions as possible.
Harry, are there any screening programs available? Is screening worthwhile? You know, we talk about screening in some of the other cancers. There's been some studies looking at chest x-rays versus CAT scans for lung cancer, mammography and breast cancer. What do we have available and what's really making a difference in head and neck cancer?
I think one of the reasons mammography, say, for breast cancer has been so successful is because there have been many really excellent studies done using that modality. For head and neck screening, I don't think we're quite as far advanced as they are, say, in breast cancer, but we do have a screening day here at Yale. In fact, the next one is coming up. It's a yearly event on April 17th at the Yale Physicians Building. Is the annual head and neck screening day. Basically, anyone can come in for head and neck screening on that day, and they'll be seen by one of the physicians there, typically asked questions about smoking habits and things like that, and have a very brief exam to see whether they have any lesions.
And you said April 17th. Now, is that something that patients need to sign up for somewhere in advance, or can they just show up at the Yale Physicians Building?
I think they may need to sign up for that. What I would suggest to them is if they call the main number of SMILO, then we can direct them to where they need to go.
Okay, terrific. You had mentioned a little bit about the tumor board. Obviously, the same team members are seeing patients in clinic, but walk us through what a clinical visit would be like for a typical patient who you perhaps suspected as having head and neck cancer. What is that half a day or day like for them?
It depends on which physician they see, but typically if they do come to see myself initially, then I will try and also have them see one of my colleagues, usually Dr. Sasaki or Dr. Judson, but they would come to the front desk. They would have a history and physical by myself, where I ask them all about their risk factors for head and neck cancer, have a look at them. And then when the ENT surgeon eventually sees them, whether it's that same day or a different day, they'll have a more thorough exam with a fiber optic laryngoscopy and maybe a biopsy at that time.
But generally, either the evaluation would be complete for a patient who came to SMILO, either in one day by a variety of the specialists who you thought might be necessary to evaluate that patient, or over just a couple of days.
That's
all
correct.
Happening at SMILO in the same building, at least, same facility, same team.
Right. In fact, Dr. Sasaki, Dr. Judson, and myself work on the same floor about two rooms away from each other. So it's very, very nice to have a true multidisciplinary team there.
I see. And we can't overemphasize enough the other members of the team, nursing, social work, you had mentioned, nutrition, dietitian, things like that.
Absolutely. And social work is one I didn't mention, but they are extremely important. Head and neck cancer, to me, is one of the cancers it's hardest to hide. If you have lung cancer or breast cancer or prostate cancer, someone could look at you and they don't know you've got cancer. If you've got a tracheostomy or a big lump in the neck, everyone's going to notice that. So it's socially a very much more difficult disease to handle, I think.
So, Harry, are there any new or current clinical trials that you're excited about? And as a follow-up question to that, why are these types of trials important?
Well, we do have some clinical trials that are either open or opening here at Yale. I'm the principal investigator on a clinical trial trying to improve on chemotherapy. And in answer to your question, one of the reasons we need these is for the patients who are unlucky enough to have cancer that spread to different parts of the body, they really don't have a very good prognosis. It's often measured in months, 6 or 10 months. So anything we can do to improve on that will be good. So the clinical trial I'm running is looking at standard chemotherapy and whether or not something called bevacizumab or Avastin will improve on the survival. And this is a very interesting compound that affects the blood supply of the tumor. It's already been approved for lung cancer, as you know, and was briefly approved for breast cancer and also approved for colon cancer. So hopefully it will be useful in our cancers as well.
Dr. Harry Deshpande is assistant professor of medical oncology and of otolaryngology.